Now, when we look at this chapter, we have to think of the context of it. It's important because some people have drawn assumptions from this chapter that are not accurate. Some have said that Paul was against marriage altogether. But when you look in the rest of the Bible, you find Paul saying marriage is honorable in all. It's an honorable thing. We know that the Apostle Paul used the marriage relationship as a picture of our relationship with Christ as he was teaching in the book of Ephesians. So we do know that there was an honoring of marriage and a sanctity of marriage. Paul was addressing problems that were in the place called Corinth. And Corinth was the home city of the god Diana of the Ephesians. It was in that particular area, the same area where there was an incredible amount of immorality, the same kind of lifestyle that said anything goes. Immorality and sexual immorality has been going on for a long, long time. And it was going on here, and it was full force. Matter of fact, it was one of the ways that you worshiped. Imagine this. One of the ways that you worshiped was that you went to a temple and you did stuff with prostitutes. That's what you did. And that was it was considered to be this, and of course, they had tourists come from all over the world, especially to the temples of Diana, because there they could go and be involved in all this kind of illicit sexual behavior. This is how the church was born in these kinds of circumstances. People, it was their lifestyle to be sexually immoral and to be living this kind of a lifestyle. And suddenly they become Christians, and all of a sudden says, oh, no, that tap turns off now. Okay? That's over. That's wrong. That is immoral. That is sinful. That is destructive. And you see some of the instructions that were given earlier in 1 Corinthians about how, you know, that if you join yourself to a prostitute, you become one flesh with them. And the warnings of it, of sexual immorality that we saw in chapter 5, in chapter 6, we saw that a man was having a relationship with his father's wife and all the kinds of things that were going on in this place. And so they were asking questions. Paul was giving answers. Some of the answers they didn't like very much, but he was trying to pull them from this whole complete lifestyle of immorality to understand this is not who you are anymore. This is not your behavior anymore. You're meant to be one man, one woman. But in the process of that, as he gives some instructions here, and I'm not going to get too explicit, but we're just going to go through the chapter, okay? Because that's where we are. So when we see, he says this, now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Well, they wrote something to him. Now, that might sound, well, that means how does the human race ever, you know, go on to the next generation, right? But what he's talking about here is, of course, the lifestyle that they were living in. It is good not to do this. It is good not to be involved in this. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, which was rampant in their culture, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. What he's trying to get them to understand is that the place for this is in marriage. This is the only place for sexual activity is to be found in marriage. And that is so foreign to that culture. That is like absolutely bizarre. But guess what? It's pretty well bizarre in our culture too. It really is. We have come a long ways, but we've come a long way down. So that now, if anybody says the only place for this kind of relationship is in marriage alone, people will think you're nuts. They do. I mean, well, of course not. You shack up, do this, do that, go with this one, go with that one, hook up here, hook up there. That's normal in our culture today, is it not? It's yes, it's almost become the norm. It is not normal for one man, one woman to stay celibate until they get married. No, it's not normal. And frankly, probably most of us in this room haven't even experienced that normality because we didn't know the Lord. And we just did whatever everybody else was doing. Even though culturally you tried to make it not look so much like that, but now it doesn't matter at all. Now it's full swing, anything goes, go for it. And of course, they've gone far beyond that to every kind of sexual perversion that you can imagine. But what does the Word of God have to say? To avoid sex because of sexual immorality, because certain people are meant to be celibate. They are. And they're fine with that, and they can live with that. Other people are meant to be married, and if you don't allow it, there's going to be immorality. There will be, and this is to avoid that kind of thing because there are desires that people have, and yet this is the place for it. This is the place where those desires are meant to be functioned and meant to be had. And this is why he says it. This is why he gives this kind of instruction. He's dealing with their issue of sexual desire. That's what he's dealing with. That's what he's addressing as he goes through this passage of Scripture. Their issues of, well, how do we deal with these desires then? If this is wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong, that's wrong, what are we going to do with ourselves? Here's what he has for an answer. And so he also says, and he says, in the marriage context, it's important that the husband render it to his wife the affection due her. It's important that the man make sure that the wife is provided for in this way so she doesn't go looking somewhere else. Am I making sense? Yes. What's the, what it says here? And likewise, the wife to her husband.
Yes.
Yeah. There would have been that, but there were plenty of, if for every man that went out with a woman, there had to be another woman. There would have been a lot of immorality every which way in those days, in that culture. The respect for a marriage relationship would have been very dim. It was in the whole Roman culture, the Greek culture. There was a, it was usually, of course, men had a lot more rule and authority, so they did a lot more things. But there was a lot of immorality in every which way that we can imagine. We won't go into all the details. But in that, in one sense, it's true that there would have been much more going on. For example, the worship of, at the Diana of the Ephesians was basically men, you know, involved. In that, of course, with the women prostitutes. There was 1,000 prostitutes in that one temple in Corinth, in Ephesus. But the instruction that's given here is that look, provide for each other. Look out for each other. Don't withhold from one another. That's what he's instructing here in 7 and 2 and 3. Don't use it as a weapon. Because it causes trouble. It can cause problems. And here's what it actually says here. It says that the wife does not have authority over her own body. Well, that goes against women's lib, doesn't it? The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. The husband has authority over the wife's body. Now, hold on. There's more. Okay. And likewise, I'm going to get in real trouble if I don't read the other half of this verse, right? Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Okay? So you can see equality here. It's nice to see it, right? Yeah. There is equality here. But it is important. It is important that we understand that the Bible is not teaching in this respect that a man, you know, does whatever he wants with his wife and she has no say. It's equal say here. In this relationship, in the physical relationship that you go on between a husband and a wife, I feel like I'm doing a marriage ceremony seminar here. But it's good stuff because it's in the Word of God. And it helps us to understand that it is important. Yes, the physical is part of the marriage relationship, and it is important. At times, it may not be important to one partner as it is to the other. But when it's not, that doesn't mean that that person says, oh, I don't feel like that, so I'm not going to do it for the next 10 years. Then you're going to run into some real problems. You're going to cause the person to possibly begin to look elsewhere, which can cause a lot of problems too. So that we need to be sensitive to each other's needs, looking for the opportunity to be a blessing to the other person. Because this is a blessing. Sex is not some dirty thing that's hidden in a corner somewhere. We live in a society that throws it all open, but throws it open in a filthy way. But we can open it up in a clean way and say, no, this is a blessing from God. It was meant to be a blessing. It was meant to be a holy thing, a thing where we rejoice in together and that we serve one another in this way, that we're careful to be sure that we are not withholding from one another in an unreasonable way. Now, there are times when you may decide, do not deprive one another. So don't do that, okay? Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time. that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again. So he says, no, listen, don't withhold from it. Don't use it as a weapon or a tool. But if you can agree together and say, because fasting can involve anything. And in this case, it speaks about saying, okay, let's put aside this for a week or for 4 or 5 days or whatever it is, or a period of time that we're going to spend time fasting and praying and seeking God and not be distracted by anything. Same as if I said, well, let's put aside certain foods. We're not going to eat certain foods for a while, just to focus more on prayer. This is what it says for fasting and prayer. But be sure to come together again so Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So that you realize, okay, yes, but at the same time, make sure that you're not pushing a person in a place where they could exercise lack of self-control. Now, everybody's different, and everybody will have different levels of passion, shall we speak, at even at different times in our experience. That will happen that way. But be accommodating, discussing, working it out, talking it through, and so that there isn't resentments and feelings that can build up inside of other partners because things are not happening the way they would like. And that's important. That's a part and part of God's plans for us. And that's what we see in these passages here. This is stuff I take through when people are getting married. Man, maybe some of you have never had these kinds of instructions from the Bible, but they're there, and they're there for our benefit so that we can grow together and not allow this to become something going off with us, but something that's growing together with us. He says, I say this as concession, not as commandment. Now he's saying, listen, I wish everybody was like I am. Now, Paul was single. So he says, well, I wish everybody was like me, but I'm saying this, you know, this isn't a commandment. I'm not saying everybody should be single. He knows better than that. But he's saying, I'm single, but everyone has their own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Some are gifted to be married, some are gifted to stay single. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it's good for them if they remain even as I am. He says, if you can, stay single, is what Paul's actually writing here. Now, he's writing in a place where there was, not only was there persecution, but there was also the growing persecution that was going to bring them to the place of being put to death. And he says, if you cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. It's better to marry than to burn with passion. Or actually, the word used in that is to burn with lust. It's better to marry than to be involved in going in illicit behavior. Especially for many of these folks, because they had become so active. If a person grows up and is not active and stays inactive, then the fires don't start. But once the fires start, it's not that easy to put them out sometimes. We certainly need a lot of grace and power in order to do that. And he says, it's better to marry than to burn with passion or lust. But to the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. But if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and a husband is not to divorce his wife. So he gives some instructions here in saying, you know, this isn't there were questions they were asking. What do we do? What do we do in a situation where I become a believer and my partner's not a believer? And, you know, what are we going to do now? Like, they're going, want to go in this direction, and I want to go in this direction. How in the world are we going to make it? They had a lot of questions. So he says, the first thing I want you to understand is that just because you become a believer, don't take off. Okay? This is what he's given them instructions here. And if sometimes they do depart, and sometimes there's necessity for that. I mean, imagine if a man comes home and says, I brought a couple of more girls with me for the night. Well, how long is a wife going to put up with that one, right? Remember the culture, okay? Remember, understand where things were at. Saying, no, I can't do this. I cannot stay in this. If this is the kind of relationship you want, I can't do this, right? And so there is a time when you do have to leave. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, she's willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. So if a man has an unbelieving wife, and most of these cases would have happened, where one became a believer, because the gospel was new. It was coming, it was invading this pagan, immoral culture. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he's willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving wife, now we have the reason why he says this. He says, if it's possible, stay together. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife. Now the word sanctified means set apart. which means that the unbeliever then in that relationship is being set apart to the gospel. They have a Christian living in with them. They have a Christian walking and talking with them. They're seeing the grace of God. They should be seeing Jesus in their partner. And that is a testimony in itself. So they're being set apart for the gospel. So if they're willing to stay with it, let them not divorce them. Now, there's a time or a situation where other things can happen. But right now, it says the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. Set apart again, sanctified again. So that the children have the opportunity to see the gospel being lived in their home by the believer. And it may bring the husband to faith in Christ, or it may bring the wife to faith in Christ, and it also may bring the children to that as well. The children are being sanctified. They're being set apart. They're having the opportunity for the gospel in their lives, which is a precious opportunity indeed. It doesn't mean they're guaranteed that they will be saved, but it does mean they're being set apart to God through this. And of course, they will be through prayer, through the witness, through the life that's being lived, and through the proclamation of the Word of God. But it says, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Now, there are differences of opinion by some folks saying that this means that they just have to stay single for the rest of their life. Others say, no, they're not in bondage. They are no longer enough to stay in that marriage, that there can be divorce in that situation and the possibility of remarriage. But God has called us to peace. You can decide what you want to say about that passage, but there certainly seems to be a liberty given to the person who has an unbeliever who walks out of that relationship, and you can't keep them, because it says, for how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? You don't know. You can't do this. You can't make it happen. So if a person who is not a believer is determined that they're done, they're going, and maybe the threat is, if you'll stop living as a Christian and come back to our old ways, then I'll stay. But if you don't, I'm gone. And then he says, listen, what else can I do in that situation? Because you don't know. You have no guarantees that you can save anybody. But then Paul says, as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let them walk, and so I ordain in all the churches. In other words, know the calling of God in your life. Know what God's calling is for you. God's calling may be to be single, and God's calling may be to be married. God knows that. No one should be telling somebody else that you need to stay single for the rest of your life, or you need to be married. God knows those things. And if we walk with the Lord, He will reveal it to us. And He'll also reveal what to do in the difficult situations. This is what He's saying here. In the hard places where there's conflict, where we're not sure, where one is against the other, and sometimes it's not easy. I know there are circumstances where one woman was told, if you go down to that church, and this was in Marguerite, your suitcases will be on the door, and that'll be the end of it. And, you know, for a while, the wife says, you know, I better stay home then. But then after a while, she realized, I can't do this. I have to go. Well, she went. And when she came back, the suitcases were not on the door. But they could have been, right? And so there are not easy situations to face. And we need the wisdom of God in all of our relationships. And relationships between husbands and wives are so intimate, and they're so powerful. They can have such an effect because two are meant to become one. And when there's that strife or division that's in there, whether it's over physical, you know, attraction and what's being done with it, it can have a tremendous effect on your marriage. Of course, it can have an effect on your marriage. Financial situations can have a tremendous effect on the marriage, because two are one. What one person does affects the other person, right? And when it comes to relationships with other people, it has a tremendous effect on our relationships. And so when you have one that's not a Christian and one that is, it's an incredible dynamic to have to work with. It's not easy. It's very difficult. So, was anyone called while circumcised? Now, he goes into other things here, and he does it for this reason, because he wants us to understand what is more important than the marriage relationship is your relationship with God. This is the most important thing. Here's what he says. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. So he's telling them, listen, it isn't an outward circumstance. It isn't this kind of thing. So let each remain in the calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Don't be concerned about it, but if you can be made free, rather use it. So he's telling him, listen, the calling that God has put on your life, you're not forced to go and get married because you become a believer. You're, even if you were involved in immoral relationships before, don't use that as the background. You're called to walk with God. And in the calling that God has given to you, follow his calling. Don't feel like you have to do what other people are doing. Or if you're called as a Jew, you don't have to become a non-Jew. Or if you're a Gentile, you don't have to become a Jew. You don't have to change these things, these outward things, but rather walk with God. If you were called while a slave, because slavery was something that was predominant in this culture, not the kind of slavery that we would equate with the deep south, okay? Not the slavery where it was normal for slaves to be beaten and everything else. A lot of times, slavery was actually indenture, which was more common even in England and in Scotland at one time, where the lords owned the manor, and then the people that worked the land, they got a certain percentage. They were indentured to them. And this was the kind of slavery that you would experience here. And many times it was an arrangement that the slave really wanted to stay in because it was beneficial to them. They were looked after in every way. They had their own home, they had their own family, and it was basically a lifetime job, kind of like working for the government, right? It provided security, and many of them wanted that position. Now, if there was an opportunity to be free, use that. Be free, Paul writes. For he who is called the Lord while a slave is still the Lord's freedman. If you belong to Jesus Christ, you're free indeed on the inside. The outward circumstances are not the most important. What's most important is that you belong to the Lord. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. So he goes a little play on words here, saying that if somebody is a slave in the world, in reality, they're free in God. They're free on the inside. And he says, if somebody is free in the world, they're actually the slave of Jesus Christ. If you belong to the Lord, you're free in the sense that you've been set free by Jesus Christ. But you're free, but at the same time, you're a slave. Now, how can a slave be really free? If you are a slave to Jesus Christ, that is, if you are a servant of Jesus Christ, you are free. You are free on the inside. A freedom comes to your soul that cannot be found anywhere else. A freedom from the power of sin and its destruction and misery in your life. A freedom from the influence of the world that dictates people in so many ways that people are like sheep who are constantly being led around in every direction by the devil and his ways, who are slaves to sin and slaves to Satan and slaves to a world system. God sets us free. So whether you are a slave, as in the world's way, or whether you are free in the world, the true freedom comes from being a slave to Jesus Christ. So Paul's beginning to pull things around to this place to cause people to understand that true freedom is in doing the will of God. True freedom is where Jesus Christ is Lord in your life. Whether you're in marriage or whether you're single, whether you're Jew, whether you're Gentile, whether you're slave or whether you're free, the real freedom comes by being a servant of Jesus Christ. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Now, in this context, he's speaking about a spiritual slavery where we become slaves of men in the sense that we become slaves to the passions and the sin and the way of the world. Instead, we've been bought. We've been bought. That's very clear. The Bible tells us in 1 Peter that we've been bought with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. We are owned by Christ. Brothers, let each one of you remain with God in that state in which he was called. The calling of God on your life. And now he goes on to say this. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, but I give judgment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has made trustworthy. Now he's saying, this isn't a direct command that everybody has to, you know, bang, 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 bang. This is it. This isn't the law here. But I'm telling you what to do in the circumstances of those who are unmarried. He says, I suppose, therefore, this is good because of the present distress. It's good for a man to remain as he is. So he's kind of saying, because of the present distress, that is the persecution and the suffering that people were facing, some of these were going to face standing before a judge who would say to them, if you don't turn from Jesus Christ, I'm going to torture your wife. I'm going to butcher your children in front of you. What would you do? What would you do when you're faced with those kinds of things? That's a hard place, is it not? Can you imagine how hard a place that would be? And yet Christians faced this, and they still face it today in some cultures and countries. If you are faced with this kind of thing, man, what Paul is saying, you're better off single. This is what he's actually saying. It's better if you're single, you're better off staying that way. And this, because of the present distress, it's good for a man to remain as he is. Don't go, because you could be facing this. You could be facing this kind of trial, the present distress. If you're bound, are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Don't go looking for a wife. Now, if I took this as to be literally law, I wouldn't have got married again. Right? But he's speaking about the present distress. That's why he's saying this isn't a command from the Lord in that respect. But under the circumstances that you're in right now, you need to really think this one through, what the consequences may be if you're going to follow Jesus Christ. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. You have not sinned. Because some people are called to be married and some people aren't. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh, but I want to spare you from it. It's not easy. There's circumstance involved with that. And he says this as well. He says, but this I say, brothers, the time is short, so that from now on, even those who have wives should be as though they had none. Uh-oh. What's he saying now? Didn't he already say that they should, you know, kind of do stuff together and be cooperative and all this kind of stuff? And now he's saying this. Is he contradicting himself? No. Here's what he's getting at. Because he goes further than that. Those who weep as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. Those who buy as though they did not possess. And those who use this world as not misusing it, for the form of this world is passing away. What's he saying to them? Higher than your marriage, higher than every relationship on this world, higher than your possessions, those who buy as though they did not possess, higher than the emotions of the moment, the circumstances that come, all the entertainment that the world offers to you, everything that goes on in this world, whether you own vehicles or whether you own nothing or whether you have this or that or the other thing, be reminded of this, that all of this is fleeting and passing. Everything is passing. It's all fleeting. And you should be living in one respect with the understanding that this is all temporary. That you have an eye to the eternal even while you're living in the physical. We already know that there's clear instructions that we are to live in this world, that we are to be, you know, involved with one another and serving one another and doing the things we do buy. But he says, not as if you possess. Using this world, but not misusing it, because the form of this world is passing away. Have your eye on the eternal. This speaks to us that what Paul is getting the emphasis here is that have that focus on Jesus Christ to be first and foremost in your heart every day in spite of everything else that goes on in life. Put Jesus first. Serve him. Let him have his way. Trust him. Now, don't be fooled. You will not lose in this. You will be the better husband, the better father, the better wife, the better person if you will put Jesus Christ first. If you will not allow yourself to be caught up by the temporary things of this world. Listen, it's amazing to me. So I watched a football game last night with my wife, and I'm not much to watch football, but I did watch it with her. But there are people whose sacred shrine is football. It is not. It is their entire life. Hockey. People who have the Toronto Maple Leaf flag on their coffin on their way out. I'm serious. Yeah, I've seen that. Or the Montreal, God, sad to say this, but the Montreal Canadian flag on their coffin on their way out. Why? Because they live and breathe it. Some people, it's basketball. Some people, it's golf. Some people, it's baseball. And we live in a world where there's so much entertainment that you can pick your poison. You can pick what it is that you think is the most important thing in the world to you, and you can follow it with all your life. Soccer, man, go to England. Soccer, they get their bodies burned, and they get the ashes, and they get them buried under the goalposts in the soccer fields. And it's like, oh, right? But it isn't. It isn't. Think about this. A rubber ball, whether it's a bouncy one or a throwy one or whatever it is, a rubber ball. We worship a rubber ball. Oh, that's my God. Or a little disc of a puck or whatever it is. That is not the beginning and the end of life. It won't matter when you're laying on your deathbed how many rubber balls you threw or bounced. None of that will matter. That is not the center of your life. Nor is a person's work, nor everything else that goes on in this world. All of it is so temporary, so fleeting, and passing away. Your presence. God is interested in the character of your life. He's interested in you as a person being developed and made whole on the inside. And I want to tell you something. Sports is not all the answers to it. I've talked to hockey moms who told me, I regret what I did with my children. These aren't even believers. They just said, it destroyed them. This idea that they were going to get so far up on this pedestal playing hockey. And in the end, they never got there. But their dreams were crushed and all kinds of circumstances went on. As they devote their whole life to hockey or their whole life to this or whole life to that. And this is why we have the Apostle Paul saying, listen, be temperate in these things. They're good. There's nothing wrong with bouncing a ball. There's nothing wrong with throwing a ball. There's nothing wrong with being involved in sports, okay? I am not here to condemn sports, but I am here to say that if those things are your God, well, you've gone down a long way. You're no better than some pagan way in the middle of some place, bowing down before a tree. Oh, tree, give me satisfaction. Oh, tree, help me with life. Oh, tree, you're my answer. Oh, football, you're my, oh, puck, you're my, oh, basketball, you're my answer. No, they're not your answer. There's not, it's not. It gives you a temporary pleasure, but it's only fleeting in its nature. Put things in their place, Paul says, even in the marriage relationship, even in everything that you do. Make sure to understand, use this world, but do not misuse it. That is the summary statement to think about in your life. Whatever it is that is your passion, someday it will cease. But the walk with God will never, because the form of this world is passing away. But Paul says, I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And so he's saying, you know, that it is true that it's going to affect your ability to serve. And Paul's saying that from his perspective. This is not saying this is it has to be. But there is some truth to that, that you're going to be focused on making sure that your family's provided for or whatever. Now, some have taken this to the point where, for example, there's religions that forbid people who are preachers to marry, thinking they're going to maybe be better ministers because they never married. But that's not what happens here in this passage of Scripture. It's not being taught here. As a matter of fact, Paul writes later on, Timothy, and says, it's a doctrine of demons to forbid people to marry. It's a doctrine from the devil. It causes grief and trouble. And we've seen some of the trouble that has come when there are people who probably should have been married, who never got married, but then they got involved in things that they shouldn't because of the temptations that come. 1 Corinthians 7:34. There's a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord. She may be holy both in body and spirit, but she who is married cares for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. He's just saying this is a practical reality that can happen here. So he's encouraging them to stop and think about the consequences of marriage or not marriage. And I had to go through that just recently. I thought about these things. I read this chapter. I prayed about it. I said, okay, God, what's going on here? And yet it was evident that God was calling me to that relationship. So, and I don't regret it. Okay, just saying. And this I say for your own profit, not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper and what you may, how you may serve the Lord without distraction, as Paul writes here. If any man thinks he's behaving improperly towards his virgin, she's past the flower of youth, and so it must be. Let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but has power over his own will, and so determined in his heart he will keep his virgin, he does well. So then he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. So he's going back and forth saying, listen, it could be one way, it could be the other. He's just saying that in these circumstances, it would be better not to marry, but if you must, then marry, and there is no sin in it at all, and follow God's leading in the matter. Now, whether it means, in some of these passages, some have interpreted it to mean that in those days, marriages were arranged, so that the father, and that was just the culture, they arranged the marriage. So if a father had virgins in his home, and then should they marry, should they not marry? Obviously, there would be consultation with them to some respect, but he was encouraging them either one way or the other, whether it is from the father's perspective of releasing, or whether it is from to a man and a woman considering whether we should stay unmarried or whether we should stay married. It's something to pray about. In 1 Corinthians 7:39, it says, a wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. If her husband dies, she's at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, but only in the Lord. And there's the kicker that says, if you're going to remarry, make sure that it is a Christian. That's right. But she is happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment. And I think I also have the Spirit of God. Now, Paul wasn't saying, oh, I might have the Spirit of God, but he was saying it in a tongue-in-cheek way. I'm pretty sure I've got the Spirit of God in these matters. So, we know that there are, when the statement is first in 1 Corinthians 7:39 sounds like there's no possibility of divorce under any circumstance or remarriage, but we know that the context, what we said it was, because, for example, Jesus said it was okay to remarry if there was a fornication on the part of the other partner, so that there were conditions for the opportunity for remarriage. But what he is getting at here, it is not a free-for-all. And it is not walk away from your family or your kids or your wife or your husband because you've become a believer and they're not. It's saying work together, work it out. If you can't, you're not in bondage in that situation. But seek to make things work. But understand this, what God is calling all of us to is a personal relationship with Jesus Christ where he is first in our hearts, ahead of your marriage, ahead of your kids, ahead of your relationships, ahead of your passions, ahead of your recreation, ahead of your job, ahead of everything else is your walk with God. Make him first in your life.